When the Lord does a work in a man or woman, things change. The first sign of this invisible change in the heart and life is often with the tongue. But the whole life has changed of that man or woman born again by the Spirit of Jesus. There's an about turn that takes place. Now there's the shunning of every evil practice, and there's a love for the Lord and his ways. Another sign of that change is a change morally. Being made male or female means we are sexual beings. So if you live in a city where fornication and all kinds of immorality is the norm for that city, what do you do when you become a Christian? Your new standard is different from those all around. You find yourself a complete stranger. So if I can give a rather poor example, it's a bit like me, a Brit, going to Japan. And the culture is so different, for example, the food, and I would be spending my time thinking about what I should and what I shouldn't be eating. So it was at Corinth, with its loose morality, a Christian had to constantly think what he should or should not be doing. It's the same in England today. We live in a moral maze. As Christians, we have to carefully navigate this moral minefield, and that's the title of the message this morning. Navigating this moral minefield that we live in. What do we do? Well, in the previous chapter, Paul had been stressing the need to avoid sexual immorality and that each Christian is to honour the Lord with his or her body. So what do we now do? Well, the mixed background of Christians at Corinth said, we'll write to Paul. We'll ask him. And chapters 7 to 15 of this letter really are Paul's response to those questions that they had laid before him. But in chapter 7, which we're at this morning, and we're looking particularly at the first 24 verses, Paul is addressing what the right sexual conduct is now that you're a follower of Christ. So it's not a treatise on marriage per se. He's really addressing the issues that have been asked. So you can see what the questions were by the answers that he gives. The first line says, verse 1, it is good for a man not to marry. Literally, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Rather than be immoral, each man should have his wife. This is the Lord's divine wisdom prescribed for preventing fornication and giving stability and many other benefits to both individuals and society as a whole. And he says, doesn't he, verse 2, since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. And in the church then, as today, there will be those who'd lived an immoral life before they were converted. And because of the immorality out there, but also in here, it is good for the Christian to direct his affections to his wife alone, and the same the other way around. And as a new Christian, you have a desire to be holy and pure, to be different. And if you're not married, to be chaste and celibate, to abstain from these things. But some had put this desire to put to death their sexual desires, had even brought that into their marriage. No, says Paul, marriage is the right place. Verse 3, the husband should fulfill his marital duties to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. Paul is answering the question, should couples continue with normal sexual relations after their conversion? And the answer is yes. And they owe it to each other to do so. Verse 4. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. Well, many men will be very happy with that statement. Men have often dominated around the world historically, and it's true today. But here comes the shock. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. So here is a statement which really pushed back against the social norms. And that's what Christ's teachings do. They confront the grossly unfair practices of the godless world. With Christ, neither person has the power over his own body alone. We are responsible for our bodies. But he's delivered that power over to the other. The wife, hers, into the power of the husband, and the husband his into the power of the wife. So implicit in this is a rejection of polygamy, of having more than one husband or wife, a rejection of adultery, because that's a breach of these marriage covenants, and all these, anything else would be a breach of the spouse's rights, a violation of the spouse's rights. So all the way down the line, Christian married couples should honour each other. And it says, verse 5, do not deprive each other except by mutual consent. Something agreed between the two of you equally. But then it says, seems to change tack here, it says, and for a time. So perhaps Paul is saying there is a time and a place. There are two different kind of extremes you can go to here. Firstly, Christians do not live as ascetics. We are not monastic. We do not, like the Roman Catholics, forbid people to marry and then open up a Pandora's box of lusts and all the shameful practices that have resulted. No, the Lord has ordained the wonderful and safe institution of marriage. However, Christians, on the other side, are not just to live for pleasure, whatever that is, whether married or unmarried. That's why he goes on to say, so that you may devote your time, yourselves, to prayer. Sounds strange, doesn't it? But he's really saying the spiritual side of life compared to the carnal. Because prayer is not just speaking, is it? Prayer is an urgent business. Prayer is a mind caught up with the Lord. And we come before him humbly, reverentially, ever conscious of his awesomeness. And that is why prayer and fasting often go together. Because that's how we are to develop our walk with the Lord. It's something we do reverently. In other words, you can't have a prayer time with a chocolate eclair in your mouth. You know, they kind of be at their opposites. So I think what Paul is saying, that the physical components of a marriage, which are part of the Lord's blessing in marriage, must for a Christian be in check with the spiritual. Time for praying with your believing husband or wife. In other words, there's a time and a place for both. And then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. In other words, think through how you're going to manage your life together. And he says, I say this as a concession, not a command. And then he goes on to say, I wish you were like me. So what about Paul? He says, each man has his own gift from God, one this gift and another that. So what about Paul? Was he married? I won't ask for a show of hands. It's very likely. Was he married?
Most likely.
Most likely? Yeah. Jeremiah sort of implies that it was very unusual for a Jew not to be married. And there's another reason why he was probably married, because it says in Acts 26 that he cast his vote in the Sanhedrin, and you couldn't cast your vote in the Sanhedrin unless you were married. So the likelihood is that he was widowed. He's a widower. Our previous minister was that, and he chose not to remarry. And it looks like Paul had chosen not to remarry. And for some it's better, actually, because our loyalties are divided, and full time can be given to serving the Lord, especially if you're like Paul, who's an itinerant minister, a travelling missionary, and that's really what the second half of the chapter is all about, and we'll look at that another day. So should the unmarried marry? Goes the next question, verse 8. Now to the unmarried and to the widows I say, and when he says unmarried, he includes the divorcee, the bachelor, the widower, because there weren't such thing as widowers in the Greek language. Widows and widowers are the same word. It is good for them to stay unmarried. So Paul commends celibacy, but only for those with that gift. And for some people it's easier than others. Verse 9, but if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. In other words, we should have self-control, but there's no point of enforced abstinence if it means being aflame with passion especially when you could marry. Sexual desire is natural, and marriage is given of God for its fulfillment. Next question. The issue of divorce comes up. Is divorce permitted for a Christian couple? No. Is the answer? No. To the married, I give this command, not I but the Lord, a wife must not separate from her husband. So when he says, not I but the Lord, Paul is saying, I don't need to say much about this because the Lord has already spoken of it when he was asked the question. And you can look at different parts of the gospel to see the answer to that. Our vows are important. The words we say are heard by the Lord, and he's going to call us to an account. So only in the case of adultery should the parties break up. In a sense, it's already happened. And I'm really, really impressed when I hear from time to time of a wronged husband or wife who then forgives and remains in the marriage. And when I'm asked about divorce, I do speak of separation as an option. Because separation is different. Separation is a practical way, maybe in a crisis, of dealing with serious problems while at the same time honouring the vows you made to the Lord. So if a couple is, every time they come together it's World War III, then, for such serious addiction or behavioural issues, then separation, I think, is a very legitimate step. Because it is saying, I still recognise the importance of marriage, and my separating is not separating for anyone else, which is what divorce is. And I think that's what Paul is saying when he carries on verse 11. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. In this marriage, the contact often remains between the two parties to see whether the relationship or a relationship can be resumed. And now we have the next question. What if my husband or wife is not a Christian? And this is more common than you think. Verse 12, to the rest I say this, I not the Lord. In other words, this is an issue that the Lord didn't speak about, so I'm going to give a bit more time to it, Paul is saying. If a brother has a wife who is not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. So when the husband or wife is converted, should old relationships be still valid? Should I continue with the unbelieving spouse? Yes. Despite the profound nature of conversion with its sudden change of direction, as I've mentioned, the Christian is not to leave his or her unbelieving spouse. In other words, the Lord knows what he's doing when he saved you. He understands all of that. And then he goes on to explain a bit more detail. It's not a one-way street, as you might have in Judaism or Islam, where the man can divorce his wife, but not the other way around, because verse 13 says, and if a woman has a husband who is not a believer, and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. So whether it's the first part, verse 12, the wife, whichever way around it is, it's symmetrical. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise your children will be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. Now, it doesn't mean the unbeliever is a believer or sanctified in that sense or personally made holy. As you see earlier in the chapter, that's not what we're saying here. But somehow, because of the love that the Lord has for his man or woman there, he kind of spills that blessing over into the rest of the family, to the unbelieving husband or wife, and also to the children. It doesn't mean the children are automatically part of the church or be baptized or anything, but at least until the age of they become adults, the Lord has a special kind of eye over that family. It's a wonderful thing. Even in a mixed marriage, the Lord is still very present. And I think we see that so often in lots of areas of life, don't we? When the Lord has this person somewhere, whether it's in a a bus or aeroplane or something, you know, perhaps, or remember the ship when Paul was travelling to Rome, you know, he saved the ship because of Paul, didn't he? So I think we often, without really realising what's going on, the Lord is watching over his people, as we heard earlier from Raymond, which is fantastic. But what if the unbelieving husband or wife cannot cope with your new direction? Verse 15, if the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. I've heard it said by one man that when his wife was converted, he felt like he'd lost his wife to another man, namely Jesus. It's kind of true. All sorts of emotions rise, all sorts of tensions suddenly appear. But actually, a man or woman who is born again by the Spirit of Jesus will be a better, more faithful husband or wife than they were before. However, the reality is that some unbelievers won't be able to cope or adjust, and they will just vote with their feet. If this is the case with your non-Christian spouse, then despite your best efforts and witness, you cannot stop him or her going. You are not to go, nor are you to drive the other person out. But if the other goes, then let them. And in a sense, there's nothing you can do about it if they decide to go. And if that is the case, you are not bound in such circumstances. Well, that word bound is used there, but it's also used at the end of the chapter in verse 39. So if you just look at that, it says, a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. And that word bound is a very strong word. In other words, you must maintain until death do us part that relationship. But the word bound here in verse 15 is a weak word, implying that a Christian is free to marry someone else, provided of course that he or she is a Christian. So if the unbeliever goes, then this seems to imply that there is liberty to marry someone else. So this principle there is because of promoting peace, isn't it? That you allow the unbeliever to go. And that's God's general will and purpose for Christians, that we are to live at peace. Well, in terms of an unequal relationship, there are two ways of looking at this. Some couples deny the spiritual state of the other person because they kind of come to church with you and you kind of make assumptions. They have faith, it's in there somewhere, although there's no evidence for it. That's one way of looking at it. Or there's another view. I know my fiancé is not a Christian, but they come to church, and when we marry, I firmly believe the Lord will bring them through. You have no idea. It's not in your control, it's in his control, and generally speaking, it doesn't happen, and you have a life of heartache. Verse 16, how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Well, how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? So if you're in a mixed marriage situation, you're in a missionary situation, really. But be strong in the Lord, be faithful, and keep praying for their conversion. And lastly, we have a general principle which is laid down here in verse 17. When you become a Christian, stay put. Don't run off from your home, or family, or work, or country, or whatever it is. Stay put. Nevertheless, each one should retain the place in life that the Lord has assigned to him, and to which God has called him. That is for all Christians of all time. He says, this is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Stay in the situation you are in, for it's the most effective place for you to be a witness to your family and to your network of friends, because those friends will quickly evaporate when you become a Christian, because you just have very little in common. So stay where you are on those early days and be a witness. And Paul gives two examples here, which we'll just look at very quickly. One is religious and one is social. So the religious one is about being circumcised. And there's some pretty scary stories about being uncircumcised, which we won't go into. Circumcision was the sign of a man being born Jewish. Well, we understand that no one is born Christian, but when you are born again as a Christian, you can come from a whole range of religious backgrounds. And we are not to try and, as the church in Galatia was forced to do, to somehow become a, you know, and occasionally you hear this, you know, to become a Christian you need to become a Jew. Not at all. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commandments is what counts, which is a bit ironic because the early commandments in the Old Testament was to be circumcised. But that's not the new commandment, isn't it? The new commandment is to love each other. To love each other. And Paul said to that church in Galatia, who are under pressure, "For in Christ neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself in love." So each one should remain in the situation which he was in when God called him. So the second part is socially. And he uses the example of a slave. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. If a slave is converted, don't mind your social status. Of course, in the early days, many of the Christians were slaves. Rejoice, you have a new boss. You have a new Lord. And he would have you stay and be a man or woman of God right where you are. However, if you can't gain your freedom, do so. And that's why, actually, quite often there's a move towards middle class, because actually when God comes in and changes things in your life, you actually start to be interested in education and all the rest of it. That's kind of an aside. But I suspect there are no slaves here this morning. But are you free? Are there some here who are not free? Jesus came to buy us freedom. For he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freedman. Similarly, he who was a free man when he was called is Christ's slave. Knowing the Lord changes, alters everything. And if you're still not one who knows the Lord, then turn from your sins. Turn to Jesus Christ. And you will be free. Free from guilt. You'll be free from judgment. You'll be free from condemnation on that last day. And you'll have power over your passions. And you will be delivered from the bondage of sin and death and brought into Christ's light and life. Wonderful change. And that is free to you, but it cost him dearly. Verse 23, you were bought at a price. And what a price! How he suffered to buy my freedom. But if you do not have Christ, you may not be a slave socially, but you're still a slave to sin. So the conclusion there, verse 24, it's kind of repeated again, isn't it? Brothers, each man, as responsible to God, should remain in the situation God called him to. And it's easy for us to say that. But if you want a new Christian in a country where there's great persecution or antagonism or war zone or whatever it is, it can be very easy just to go. And it's understandable. And what happens quite often is somebody's converted in India or some other place, or maybe the Middle East, and they think, I want to go to Bible college. They go to Bible college in the West and they never go home. Never go back. So the Lord saves people in certain places to be a witness where we are. And it's the Christian's moral uprightness, more than anything else, that stands out. And that's what changed the Roman Empire, was the moral standard of many Christians. Many had become Christians, and it was their moral position that changed things, and it spread across the whole of the Roman Empire. So we as Christians must see the changes that take place then as being something that can happen again if we are to live differently from anyone else in our post-Christian Britain. So let's take on board what we've heard this morning and live differently for his glory. Amen.